This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the great actress Annette Bening. She's best known for her roles in The Grifters, American Beauty, The Kids Are All Right, and 20th Century Women. She's been convincing as a seductive con artist and as a single mother who's feeling increasingly distanced from her teenage son. She's now starring in a film adaptation of Chekhov's 1895 play, The Seagull. Bening plays Irina, a famous and narcissistic aging actress, trying to convince herself and others that she's still in her prime. Our film critic David Edelstein wrote, "There's no living actor more able to show the tension between the performer and the desperate person underneath, struggling to hold the mask in place." Set in Russia, The Seagull is about a family and friends spending time together on a country estate. Each person is in love with someone else in the group who doesn't love them back. It's also about two generations of theater people, Irina and her son, who rebels against her and wants to shake things up with a new kind of theater. The son is in love with a young actress, Nina, but the actress falls in love with Irina's lover, Boris. In this scene, it's time for Irina and Boris to return home, but Boris begs her to stay an extra day. Irina is sure it's because Boris wants to spend more time with young Nina. Boris is played by Corey Stoll.
Darling, why can't we stay?
Because, darling, I know why you want to stay, but get control of yourself. You're a little drunk. Sober up.
No. Be reasonable. You're capable of sacrifice. Be a true friend. Please, be generous. Let me go.
Be generous? What, are you that infatuated with her?
I'm attracted to her. This could be what's missing in my life.
What? The love of a little country girl? That's how little you know yourself?
I can't stop thinking about her. Even now, I'm talking with you, but it's as if I'm asleep.
No,
I'm possessed by the thought of her. This could be my last chance at a love like this. Please, I'm begging you. Let me go. Let me go.
No. You can't say those things to me, Boris. I'm just a woman, like any other.
This is your chance to be a woman unlike any other.
You're torturing me. Please, you're scaring me.
Never known love like this before. When I was young, I spent every minute struggling to survive, and now it's in front of me, a love I've never known, and you want me to run away from it?
You have lost your mind.
I don't care! Please, let me go.
Oh.
Annette Bening, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. I'm such a fan. Most of us know you through movies, but you actually got your start on stage doing classic theater like Chekhov. In fact, you did The Seagull when you were young, right? Like when you were in your 20s, right after college or in conservatory?
Yeah, when I was in acting school at the American Conservatory Theater, I did it when I was a student there, which was an incredible experience. It's what most people do when they're in acting school. Chekhov is a big part of all of our educations because he was such a brilliant writer, and because he was writing at the time that basically modern acting was getting articulated in a way that we now understand it by Stanislavski, who was an actor in The Company and became this great teacher and writer about acting. And so it all happened at the same time at turn of the century Russia. So we all studied the plays, and so I did get to do it when I was in my second year at ACT. So,
yeah. So as an actress, what strikes you as being the most original, the biggest break from the past in The Seagull?
Well, the roles for women at that time, written by Shaw, Ibsen, Chekhov, and a few others, reflected how that was the beginning of really an enormous change in all over the world in women's lives. And Chekhov particularly loved women. He, in fact, fell in love with the leading actress of the Moscow Art Theater, and they got married, and he wrote these parts for her. She played the role that I play in The Seagull. But he had many love affairs and was clearly a guy who was interested interested in women, but also had great sympathy for them. And so the kinds of women that you see in his plays, women who are like Masha in The Seagull, who's basically probably a drug addict and certainly an alcoholic. And she is hilarious and funny, but she's also got a very dark side. So these kinds of women had never really been seen dramatized before. And Chekhov was really at the beginning of that time where the complexity of women's inner lives was being dramatized really for the first time.
So you had, I'm sure, like some kind of vocal training during your stage work when you were studying classic theater. Can you talk about that at all, about what you learned about how to project your voice in a theater without a microphone, how to enunciate without sounding false?
Oh, I loved all that stuff. I loved, we had lots of voice classes as well as speech. So voice classes is about understanding the physiology of breathing, basically, because volume is just a question of being able to take in a lot of air and expend it quickly. That's basically volume. So trying to do that in a natural way. We learned a lot about analysis of text as well, and how different inflections in your voice can invite different responses from the audience. The guy that created ACT is a man named Bill Ball. He, among others, founded the theater, and they had a repertory theater as well as this conservatory that I was a part of. And he used to talk about the sustained inflection a lot and how important it was to understand the difference between a down ending and an up ending and a sustained inflection, and that the sustained inflection is something that hopefully leads one to listen because you're leaving blank air where there's no resolution in the voice. And he talked a lot about that. He would do it over and over. He would literally play notes on the piano and try to teach us about inflection and all of that stuff. And I found all of that quite fascinating, actually. I loved it.
I don't know if you would agree with me about this, but I find sometimes when I'm watching actresses on stage that when they speak louder, their voices get higher. And my voice gets higher when I speak louder.
Really?
Yeah. If I'm speaking in front of an audience and I'm not confident in the microphone, I start talking like this.
I think so, that happens to me, too. Well, I think
what,
definitely.
No, but give me some advice. Give me some advice that other women could use, too. What should we do in a situation like that where we hear our voices getting higher as they get louder and they don't need to get higher in pitch?
Well, with that or with any kind of nervousness, because basically what that's coming from is pressure and stress and nervousness that we all feel, because that's normal. We're getting up in front of people or we're on the radio in front of people talking, and it's nervous making. So when I was thinking about doing this interview, I really respect you. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I was nervous, right? So I'm thinking, so as I'm sitting here, I'm deep breathing. That's what I do. I mean, really, that is what they taught us in school. And it is, of course, taught in many different ways. But to take the time to stop and make sure you're inhaling deeply to prepare and exhaling. In fact, if anything, the more important part is to remember to exhale, because we tend to hold our breath and when we get nervous, and then that's part of how our voices start to get higher as we go, because we're nervous, and that all begins to clench up in our diaphragm. So we were taught to remember to keep breathing and breathing deeply. That helps a lot to ground you in the moment. And I still practice that all the time, especially once you're actually doing something. Because once you're actually in the moment and acting, hopefully your mind is very clear. You're not really thinking in the same discursive mind that you normally do. You're hopefully finding a place where you're not really thinking a lot, except you're looking at your partner, you're listening, you're trying to take in the moment, and then you're trusting that all that stuff that you've thought about beforehand will work for you. But one thing you can definitely still consciously do is breathe. Make sure you're breathing.
In the last few years, I feel like I've been seeing you in more movies and really happy about that. I think I'm right in saying that you kind of slowed down when you were raising your children. You have four children. So are you kind of fully back in the swim of it now that your children are in the late teens and 20s?
It has definitely made a difference. My youngest is 18, just mm-hmm. turned 18. She's just about to go away. So, it does make a difference because when they're little, you got to be on the floor. And when you're on the floor, a lot of the time you can't be off doing stuff. But, so that's true. I have been able to do more, and that's great fun for me. I really enjoy being able to respond spontaneously and go off and do stuff when I can.
I think for women, it's kind of frightening to take time off to raise their children because they never know. If they want a career, they never know if they'll be able to get back in when they feel ready, when they feel like their child or children are old enough to re-enter the workplace or re-enter full time. Were you ever worried that people in the movie industry would forget you or write you off?
There were times I suppose I would worry about that. I also found that when I stopped for the first time to have my first baby, I really lost the desire to work. And that was quite a shock because I'd always loved it so much. And I thought, oh no, you know, does this mean I'm not going to want to do it anymore? But what I realized was that that was a cyclical thing, and it happened each time I had a baby. And I really enjoyed being away from show business, quite frankly. I really enjoyed stopping and turning way in the other direction of life and just being with my family. And so that was a great pleasure. And then I was able to stop and start a lot, which I never really thought about that before I had kids as an actress, that would be such a wonderful thing to be able to do because, of course, so many people can't. They just can't stop and start. But in my profession, I can. So I was able to take years off at a time. And then I guess I had just sort of enough going on that I felt like there would be something out there when I went back. But there's always lulls and ups and downs, and that certainly was true for me.
So you recently, it was a few years ago, starred with Julianne Moore in the Lisa Cholodenko movie, The Kids Are All Right. And you and Julianne Moore played a married couple with two teenage children who were fathered by a sperm donor, an anonymous donor. The teenage daughter tracks down the sperm donor, and you reluctantly agreed to a family meeting with him, and he changes the whole family dynamic. Your kids start hanging out with him. You later figure out your spouse, Julianne Moore's character, is having an affair with him. I want to play a scene. This happens at a restaurant after you've had a fight. You're at a table with some friends. You and Julianne Moore have had a fight. Then you go to the bar part of the restaurant and start trying to talk it through, but the fight gets a little worse.
Oh my God, what is going on with you?
It's this whole Paul thing. It's just driving me crazy, all right? I feel like he's taking over my family.
No.
Let me get you anything.
No, thanks. No, he's not. He's not.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, right? Oh, I guess I'm just exhausted.
Yeah, maybe you just need to take some time off. Recharge, right?
Yeah, right. Who's going to pay for that? I mean, look, I'm sorry, but, you know, I feel like I'm carrying the whole load here.
Yeah, because that's the way you like it. It's the way you keep control.
What are you talking about?
Come on, you hated it when I worked. You wanted me at home, taking care of the kids. You wanted a wife.
That is just not true.
No, you didn't like any of the nannies, and you sure didn't back my career.
What are you talking about? I just helped you start another business.
Yeah, so you can feel better about yourself.
No, Jules. So you can feel better about yourself.
Are you even attracted to me anymore?
Okay, that's my guest, Annette Bening, with Julianne Moore from the 2010 movie The Kids Are All Right. What parts of yourself did you draw on to play this role?
Let's see. I loved this part. I felt so at home in it. I love Nick a lot. I guess just like always, that's what I always do, is draw on parts of myself when I'm working. So I'm sure I have a part of me that is trying to control. I'm sure I have that. I'm sure my husband would say that. And my kids probably too. I think I keep it under control, that I'm not too bad at with that. But certainly that's true. I would say I have that. Yep.
So I'm thinking that in the past few years, you've probably thought a lot about sexual orientation and about gender, in part because of this role in The Kids Are All Right, and also because I know your oldest son is trans, and I know you try to let him speak for yourself and not speak on his behalf, and I will not ask you to do that, but I have a question about you. Having a trans son, and having played a lesbian in a movie, has that gotten you to think any differently about issues of identity when it comes to sexual orientation or gender?
Absolutely. And it's one of the pleasures of acting is that every time we get to enter this other imaginative world that's not our own, or in this case, sexual orientation or whatever, it's such a fabulous, way to expand your own heart and your own thinking. Because when you play a character, you have this fabulous thing that you can be completely subjective, and you don't have to judge the person. You only have to totally back them up. You're their advocate. You're fighting for everything that's in their lives, just like in some ways we fight for what's important to us in our own lives. And with my children, I feel like, especially now that they're young adults, I'm just learning more and more from them for so long. You know, you feel like you're teaching your children about the world. And now, for sure, I feel the opposite way, that they're teaching me about the world. That's true of all of my kids, certainly true of my oldest son, Stephen, that there's been a whole new kind of universe opened up to me and to all of us in the family because of Stephen, because who he is. And that is a fantastic part of being a parent. I love it.
So here's a question about gender identity that I want to ask you as the parent of a trans teenage son. Was it a steep learning curve for you to learn about this?
Yeah, it was. My son's now 26, and so when he came out, it was many, 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 many years ago when he was a teenager. So, yeah, it was, definitely. And I think there's a lot more out there now for people to read about, to understand, because it's so much more a part of the cultural conversation.
So, you're 59 now. To my knowledge, you haven't had cosmetic surgery. And your face has some natural wrinkles in it, and I want to thank you for that. I understand and respect why many women and men would have work done, but as someone who isn't going to do that, I really love seeing women and beautiful women like you age naturally and just see how life changes one's face and to see how beautiful you remain. And it enables your face to be so much more expressive than if you've had a lot of work done, because I think your skin gets so stretched so tight, it's hard to have those kind of subtle changes of expression that seem so important to have when you're an actor. But when you're an actor, it's almost expected that you're going to do this.
I appreciate you saying that. It's funny, when people ask me about this, my first impulse is always to try to defend other people that choose to do that.
No, so I exactly.
Feel, and I, you know, which you did. Yeah, it was in your question, which I also feel that it's just a personal choice, right? Something that we all have to ask ourselves. And of course, as actors, one of the things that we do is we face ourselves, or at least that's part of what we do. And that is not always easy, whether it's literally or figuratively. Facing oneself is part of the process. So for me, that's the choice I've made, is not to do any of that. I don't consider it virtuous. It's just me. That's my approach. Maybe it's because I also started in the theater, and when I first kind of formulated my own aspirations as an actress, one of them was to continue acting all my life, and that I wanted to try to portray the age that I was, and not get stuck in any given period of life, and that was part of my sort of idea about what I wanted to do. So that's just the choice that I've made.
So I want to ask you one question about your marriage, which I know is very private. But you're married to Warren Beatty. You met on the set of Bugsy, which you both starred in. And, you know, he had a reputation at the time of being, like, quite the playboy. And, like, you've been married for over 20 years. You have 4 children together. What made you think at the time that someone who had that kind of, like, playboy reputation would be capable of, like, settling down and building a family?
It's actually 26 years now.
It's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. Let's see. I don't know. Going back to your instincts, I trusted my instincts, let's say. So that's what I did. I fell in love. We wanted to have children, and we started doing that right away. And turns out we did the right thing.
Good. Okay, so when you're home and the TV is on and you're going across the channels and one of your earlier movies comes on, do you leave it on or do you turn it off?
If I have time, I will often watch it. And it's quite fun because what happens when you make a movie is you have all these memories of the moment when you're doing the scene or the day or whatever it is. And so the associations you have while you're watching the film are all to do with things that have nothing to do with the movie itself. So you're having that experience that, of course, no one else has because everyone else is just watching it for what it is, the story that's being told. So as more time goes by, I forget more and more about what was happening at the time. So I can watch the movie and see it differently. So I've done that. I've watched movies that I haven't seen in a long time and thought, wow, it seems like another lifetime sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. And sometimes I feel really proud, and generally brings back great memories because I've been so lucky and I've got to do so many things that I love so much.
Annette Bening, it's just been a treat to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Annette Bening stars in the new film adaptation of Chekhov's The Seagull. That's Cardi B, a rapper in her mid-20s who's one of the most popular recording artists around. With her breakthrough song, Bodak Yellow, she became the first female rapper to have a number one hit single in 20 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Cardi B's debut album, Invasion of Privacy. Big pop mixed with Tupac, I'm like Machiavelli. Nita, little Caesar pizza, I be hot and ready. You a and a rat, you like Tom and Jerry. You ain't ballin', you just talking, that's that commentary. I was in the field, man, I slayed for this. Had to talk to God, drop down and pray for this. To my surprise, he replied, say you made for this. I seen the car, wanted, then I went and paid for it. Cash, cash, hit the take care.
Cardi B has worked hard to get to where she is now. A former gang member and stripper, she found her initial fame as part of the TV reality show Love & Hip Hop New York. As a reality star, she was a real character, hyper-assertive. As a rapper, she tells her truth with both anger and a great sense of profane humor. Listen to the way she both refers to her past and declares a triumphant present and future in the song Drip. I gotta work on my anger, might kill a bitch with my fingers. I gotta stay out of Gucci, I'm finna run out of hangers. Is she a stripper, a rapper, a singer? I'm busting blacks in a belly, my tiger. Right through your hood like bitch, I'm the mayor. You not my gang, them bitch will die. Came through drippin', drip, drip. Came through drippin', drip, drip. Came through drippin', drip, drip. Diamonds on my wrist, they drippin'. Ice, came through drippin', drip, drip. Her stint on Love & Hip Hop proved that Cardi is a natural TV star. Television brings out Cardi's gift for the absurd and the silly, and talk shows have been eager to exploit this. The week her album was released, Jimmy Fallon had her co-host an entire show with him, something that had never been done on The Tonight Show before. Fallon tried to use her as a human punchline, to connect her to an older era of female guests who were invited on to be simultaneously sexy and wacky. The reference point for baby boomers would be, remember Charo, the so-called coochie coochie girl? But Cardi ultimately took control. She always does. Slim waist, fat, fat. It's caked on my back. Activate without no makeup. The collard greens, cornbread, neck bone, back, back. Get it from my mama and you don't know where your daddy at. Knick, knack, daddy whack. Give a dog a bone. Put it on him, big then never coming home. Flex like a boy. I'm a 10, she a joy. Stupid, unimportant, unattractive, unemployed. Get some wop. This debut album, Invasion of Privacy, does a lot to expand Cardi B's musical range. Her instinctive pose is that of a tough realist, a self-proclaimed feminist who goes after what she wants. But Invasion of Privacy allows for a few more vulnerable moments, such as Be Careful, in which Cardi sings longingly for a lover who'll be tender and respectful.
Like the Curry, Steph and Aisha. But we more like Belly, Tommy and Keisha. Gave you TLC, you wanna creep it. Pulled out my whole heart to a piece. Man, I thought you would've learned a lesson about liking pictures, not returning texts. I guess it's fine, man, I get the message. You still stutter after certain questions. You keep in contact with certain exes. Do you though? Trust me. Cool though, said that you was working, but you out here chasing who knows. But you lies, chilling poolside, living two lives. I could've did what you did to me to you a few times. But if I did decide to slide, find somebody, let him hit, you would've been pissed. But that's not my MO, I'm not that type of. And karma for you is gonna be who you end up with. Don't make me sick.
One of the best tracks on this album connects with Cardi B's roots. Her mother is from Trinidad, her father is from the Dominican Republic. She's said that this background informs some of her music, such as the rhythm of I Like It, which samples the hook from Pete Rodriguez's 1967 hit, I Like It Like That.
Diamonds, I like stunning, I like shining, I like $1 million deals, where's my pen? I'm signing, I like those Balenciagas, the ones that look like socks. I like going to the jeweler, I put rocks all in my watch. I like texts from my exes when they want a second chance. I like proving wrong, I do what they say I can. They call me Cardi, Cardi, banging body, spicy mommy, hot tamale, hotter than a Somali, bird, go, Rari, hop up the stool, jump in the coupe. Big dip on top of the roof, flexing them as hard as I can. Eating halal, driving a Lamb. So that I'm sorry though, got my coins like Mario. Yeah, they call me Cardi B, I run like cardio. Diamond district in the chain.
Much of the most popular hip-hop right now comes from the South, where some rappers intentionally slur and blur their rhymes and rhythms. Cardi B, however, hails from the Bronx, and she makes sure you hear every word, every joke, every pun, every stinging insult. Invasion of Privacy is, among other things, a statement of principles, an assertion of pure will. Or as she phrases it, I'm my own competition, I'm competing with myself.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Cardi B's debut album, Invasion of Privacy. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic, actor, and writer Tig Notaro. She has a new Netflix comedy special that premieres Tuesday. The last time she was on our show was in October 2012. She was coming out of an awful period. Within the span of a few months, she had pneumonia, a life-threatening intestinal infection. She was diagnosed with breast cancer and had a double mastectomy. She and her girlfriend broke up, and her mother died suddenly in a freak accident at home. Just a few days after Notaro received her cancer diagnosis, and before she had publicly talked about it, she did a previously scheduled comedy set at the L.A. club Largo that took everyone by surprise and left the audience stunned. Here's how she began.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi. How are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? Ah, it's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God. Oh my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation. Oh, it's fine. Here's what happened. It's very personal. Found a lump. Guys, relax, everything's fine. I have cancer.
Tig Notaro had been doing stand-up for years, but that set made her famous. A lot has changed since then. She's recovered from her double mastectomy. It's unlikely the cancer will return. Professionally, she's had an HBO comedy special and was the subject of a Netflix documentary. She co-wrote and starred in a semi-autobiographical series on Amazon called One Mississippi. She wrote a memoir. She fell in love with actress Stephanie Allen. They married and now have twin boys. So here's an excerpt of Tig Notaro's new Netflix comedy special called Happy to Be Here.
For the majority of my adult life, I have been mistaken for a man at least once a week. It's more than that, but I don't want to seem like I'm exaggerating. But I also feel confident that probably nobody here is like, eh, we're going to need some examples. And it doesn't bother me. I feel comfortable with who I am. I know who I am. I know what I am. You can call me a choo-choo train. Doesn't matter. I know who I am. Now, I can't believe it took me 46 years to come up with this response. And if this happens to you, please feel free to use it. Give me credit. Because it's good. I went into a shop and walked up to the counter, and the man behind the cash register said, "How can I help you, sir?" And I said, "Just the gum, ma'am." And we were just in this lockdown moment of utter confusion, just like, yeah, I don't know what I'm looking at either. I don't know how he felt about that exchange, but I know for myself, I did leprechaun kicks the entire way home.
That's Tig Notaro from her upcoming Netflix comedy special, Happy to Be Here. Tig Notaro, welcome back to Fresh Air. That whole idea of being mistaken for a boy or for a man is a recurring theme in your comedy. Did it ever bother you, like when you were a kid or a teenager?
Yeah, I think when I was little and, you know, getting teased for looking like a boy, it bothered me then. And I think just growing up and becoming an adult and realizing how it's kind of ridiculous to get mad about it.
So I want to ask you about another really groundbreaking comedy set that you did. This was an HBO special. And, you know, kind of in the middle of the special, you talk about being in an airport after having your double mastectomy, and a woman security guard at security pats you down on your chest. And she feels like you don't have breasts, you don't have nipples, and she's utterly confused. And as we already established, a lot of people confuse you with being male. And so, like, she's really kind of baffled. And it's a funny bit. And then when you're done telling the story, you start taking off your jacket and then unbuttoning your white shirt. And then you take both of them off and reveal your chest post-double mastectomy. Mm-hmm. And then you let the audience kind of look at you for a while. And then you keep telling airport jokes. Like, and it's kind of stunning and hilarious at the same time. Uh-huh. Can you talk about the process of, one, deciding you were going to take your shirt off on stage, and two, figuring out how do you get in to that part and how do you come out of that part?
Well, after I had surgery and I was going home from the hospital, and, you know, it was the tail end of so much in a series of events I had gone through, and there I was in the car going back to my place just thinking, oh my gosh, like, now I have these just wounds across my chest with stitches. And then my brain just immediately in that drive home went to, oh my gosh, what if I did stand up with my shirt off? And it just tickled me on this really deep, deep level. And I told my friend, Lake, who was with me when I was, at home. And she was like, oh my gosh, you have to do that. And I was like, oh yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll do that. I don't know. I went back and forth in my head, but it really made me laugh. And then I started doing stand-up regularly. And when I would be in front of these audiences, it just, the thought kept running through my head, oh my gosh, I could take my shirt off right now. And I was trying to get used to my body. I was trying to get comfortable with my body. And I had some shame and sadness and discomfort about the way I looked after my surgery. I think that my brain going to, oh, take your shirt off, was something that I thought might help me move through it.
Did it?
And yeah.
Did you feel like once you took your shirt off in front of an audience and they gave you a kind of positive response to that, that you had nothing to feel embarrassed or ashamed about anymore or uncomfortable about? It wasn't hidden. It wasn't a hidden thing where you had to worry about people's reactions. It was out there.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, my story was so public at that point, so people mm-hmm. knew I'd had a double mastectomy, but it's still different when, you know, it took me a very long time to be able to look down at my own body just in the privacy of my own home. When I took a sponge bath or something, I always looked at the ceiling because it was so painful for me. And yeah, I think that seeing that response and hearing and feeling the response of the crowd, and nobody had to say any particular sentence. It was in the audience reaction, the cheering, that I heard everything I needed to hear.
So can I ask you a couple of Louis C.K. questions?
I guess we'll see what the questions are.
Sure. I'll ask the questions and you could tell me if you're comfortable answering them. So just as background, you did, you know, that groundbreaking set at Largo that we talked about. There was only like a few hundred people in the audience, but there was an audio recording made, and it got a large national audience after Louis C.K. tweeted about your set and then asked with your permission to sell it on his website. And which he did, and it was kind of a sensation. And he was also credited as the executive producer on your Amazon series, One Mississippi. But after he became attached to the series, you heard stories about how he'd masturbated in front of women comics. He initially said that was all just rumors, and then he confessed and apologized. What was the process like for you once you started hearing these stories of figuring out what you were supposed to do, how you should respond to it, both in terms of the creator of the show that he was listed as executive producer on, and also in terms of just deciding what, if anything, to say to him, if to ever talk with him again, like what to do to tell other people or to keep it to yourself, how to deal, you know, all of that. Sorry, that's a huge question.
Yeah. Before we even shot the pilot, I had seen sides of him that I had not seen before. And I also want to back up and clarify, Louis isn't an old friend of mine. And because he promoted that album, Live, people assumed that we had been friends for years and we hadn't ever eaten a meal together, you know? it's not like I came up with him or had some big history with him. There's comedians that you meet over the years, and he's one that I had met, but he popped into Largo the night I was doing my set, and that was kind of the beginning of it all. I had certainly performed with him a couple of times before, but I just want to clarify that I don't have a huge history with him. And so when he called me to do this TV show that became One Mississippi, I agreed to do the show. But then when we were moving towards doing the pilot is when I saw sides of him that I hadn't seen. And I shared that with other people. And that's when I started hearing stories about the, you know, behavior. But the five people that ended up in the New York Times article, four of them were friends of mine. And before that article came out, once I had confirmation that he had done this, I started publicly trying to separate myself from him.
Did you feel at all conflicted because, you know, he'd given your career such a big boost, and then you found out things that you found really bad that he'd done. So was it hard for you to separate yourself in the way that you did because he had helped you? Because there was a side of him that was, you know, was very good to you.
There was a side, but I couldn't help but, looking at all of the pieces, wonder what his motivation was.
Well, you actually said that you were afraid he released your album to cover his tracks, that he knew it was going to make him look like a good guy supporting a woman.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of manipulation. I think there's a lot of abuse. I think I don't know what to think. And I know that people can surround themselves with situations and people and projects and whatever to protect or make things look okay or like they're positive or in support of women or certain people, but I don't know. It's very odd behavior.
So I know this is hard for you to talk about, so let's move on to another subject.
Thank you.
So, you know, the last time we spoke, we talked a lot about some terrible things that had happened in your life. You had gotten pneumonia. You had C. difficile, which is this absolutely horrible intestinal infection that can cause death. You'd become kind of skeletal as a result. Then when you got out of the hospital, soon after you were diagnosed with cancer, and in the middle of what I just said, your mother died. So it's just seemed...
And my girlfriend and I split up.
I'm sorry that I forgot to mention that.
Yeah. Come on.
What was I thinking?
There's other things too, but yeah.
So, but since that whole like really miserable chapter of your life, some great things have happened to you. Like your career has taken off. You got married to Stephanie Allen, who you met on the set of In a World, and you were still sick when you were on the set.
Yeah, I had all of those diseases at one time and didn't know it.
But now you're married? You have two children?
Yeah, she married me anyway.
Yeah, you have twins. So it just seems like, whoa, you know, total flip of your life. What kind of wedding did you have?
It was gigantic. We thought we were just going to go someplace and get married privately, just the two of us. And we started going to all these weddings after we got together. And Stephanie at one point said, I think I want to have a big wedding. And I said, I'm feeling that way too. And this was before marriage had become legal nationally. And so I said, you know, I'd really love to get married on the beach in my hometown in Mississippi. And we were having the wedding on the beach, and then we were going to walk across the street, and my cousin lives across the street, and we had the reception at their house. And when we talked to my cousin's they asked, well, how many people are you thinking? And we said, oh, you know, like, I don't know, 200? Even though in our heads we thought 350, we were just trying to get a gauge. And they're like, oh, yeah, we thought you meant like a really big wedding. And we were like, well, like, I mean, would 350 be a problem? They're like, no, 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 that's not a problem at all. And so there were 350 people on the beach in this little town in Mississippi, and the local police, it became legal. It was crazy because it became legal the day after we sent out our wedding invitations. And the local police shut down the road in both directions, and there was just traffic lined up for miles. And we were all headed, you know, down the street to my cousin's house, and all of our friends in from New York and L.A. and Texas and Colorado, everywhere. And I think people didn't know what to expect for a gay wedding in small town Mississippi. And it was really the most beautiful day. And the neighbors were running out of their houses yelling, this is so beautiful, congrats, and, you know, following us all down the road. And I turned to Stephanie and I said, I bet they think I'm a man. I'm so used to it. It's like
Well, Tig Notaro, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on again. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, which is the name of your special. Good work.
Thank you.
The name of Tig Notaro's special, which premieres on Netflix May 22nd. Thanks again, Tig.
Thank you.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.